Good morning to everyone, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Millie Moffitt. I am a member of the Social Action Committee, and so I stand here this morning to help lead us through our order of service. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background. Whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, your family structure, we welcome you, no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, as we will have this morning, or by Sandra Ingham, who is our minister. This morning's offering will be shared with the Tenet Resource Center, and you will be hearing more about that as our service proceeds. Our opening words this morning are by Sue Grabia. Where is Sue? There's Sue.
And I go by Susan. That's my birth name. So once more, by Amy Bowden Friedman. Once more, the earth has turned toward the light of the sun, as we are bathed in the light of a new day, so we may greet the dawning of fresh possibility. Once more, we awaken from our slumber. As our bodies rise to meet the challenges and pleasures of living, so may our hearts and minds open with promise. Once more we gather for worship. As we join our voices in word and song, so may this assembly bring forth wholeness. Come, let us worship.
Peter, you will light our chalice, please.
Around us, light is returning. It rekindles the spirit of life in the skeletons of trees. It brings forth new shoots from the soil. It wakes us from our winter slumber and invites us to see what lies beyond. We light this chalice in the spirit of our Earth's awakening and to reaffirm our commitment to the value of home.
We now come in our program to the presentation of our guests this morning, who are going to share with us what they are all about and what they are doing. Our first guest, who I note here, is Julio Garcia. Julio is there in the back. He's coming forward. Julio, I understand.
That should be me.
Yes. I understand you're a native of Spain.
I am.
He is.
Although from my accent you may think I'm from the Upper Peninsula. I am not.
And you moved to Madison when? About 10 years? 15, I have 15 years
ago.
Yeah,
2003.
2003, all right.
And this feels like home.
And it feels like home.
Yeah.
And why don't you tell us what you are doing in the name of the project for which you work?
Yep, we are, me and Mary, we both work for the Tenant Resource Center. Probably you are familiar with it. I mean, I'm from Madison, I know. Basically, I'm just trying to present a little bit of what we do, and then Mary is going to be talking about this more specific stuff about homelessness. Okay, basically, the three main areas that the Tenant Resource Center works with, it's housing counseling, eviction prevention, and homeless services. Okay, in the housing counseling, I guess that's the people know us more for. Basically, you can go to our office on Willie Street, you can give us a call, and basically we just answer questions about your housing rights. We cover all the state, okay, so we get a pretty good amount of calls. So that's basically, we inform, we are not lawyers, we are not attorneys, we just inform people about what the law says. Okay, these are your rights, so you should assert them. In that area, we also try to do a lot of outreach give presentations to, the more people are better informed about their rights, the more they are going to be able to assert them. And we see a lot of abuses in rental, especially with people who are vulnerable. The more vulnerable you are, the more abused you're going to be. So if you are able to assert your rights, like basically go to your landlord and say like, hey, this is what the law says, and this is not what you are doing, at least they can give some break from some of the situations they might be in. We also give presentations, as I said, like we give presentation in Spanish, English, broken English, it's your choice. And that's a good part. That's what I like the most, because I think like just even one person who attends there, it's not one person you are talking to. It's a whole family, a whole network of individuals that as long as they know, like you have a housing problem, as long as you remember, hey, talk to these guys, they might be able to help. That's probably the most of it. On another area, we are working with eviction prevention. We are trying to help people avoid evictions in the sense like basically see if they can have any way out of the eviction through the rules. Maybe the landlord did something not right in the whole process. And we are every day, every Tuesday, we are at the courthouse helping people with evictions, letting them know what the process is, because I know it's a very stressful process. Like most of the people who are there have never gone through that. You don't really know what you are supposed to do. You don't really know what all that is about. So at least you know what's coming after that. And we have some eviction prevention funds now from the city. So we are able, it's not that much money. To qualify, not everybody qualify. A lot. It's more like a homeless prevention, like a homelessness prevention. Like, but at least we are able to give those funds to try to stabilize people at home. Okay, our numbers show that if the people we help, I think it was like 80% stay in their home after 6 months. It's a huge thing. Like even like all the people who can help, like all those people who can have a stable housing, that's a huge thing, because once you are homeless, the biggest a prediction of homelessness is homelessness. Yeah, if you have been homeless before, you go through that episode again, it's hard to get out of there. So if we can keep those people housed, we can see that the numbers, that it matches up. Okay. And we also used to have some money, like security deposit loans, a program to give help people with security deposit, because that's something that prevents a lot of people from getting into housing. Like, okay, you may have a job, you are making it through, but can you make, to get into a home, can you make the money for a first month's rent and security deposit? That's a lot. For many people, that's basically impossible. So if you can help them with the security deposit, that allows a lot of people to get into housing. That very simple thing, those $600, those $700, that allows people to get into housing and start from there, and now they can make the payments, they can make their monthly rent. But our money got depleted in that. It was hard to get all the money back, so we are trying to find a way to resurrect that program. So, and I think Mary is going to talk about the homeless services, which know much more than me.
So, hi, my name is Mary. I'm sorry, that's where we have to So I worked as a street reach out worker for 4.5 years. Madison has about 800 people who are considered chronically homeless, and that's the HUD definition of someone who's either been homeless for a continual year or who have had 4 periods of episodes of homelessness within the last 3 years. Personal opinion, the HUD definition does not reflect the reality of most of the people on the street. I think we're undercounted. The US just had a January, it's called point in time count. Across the United States, we have about 550,000, half a million people who are counted homeless, and I think that's very conservative because they don't count people who are maybe staying with relatives or friends or who are in a motel that night. So my experience with working with people on the streets is they need someone working with them to get them through the process. The process in Madison, and I'm assuming throughout the United States, is so complicated that for sometimes you hear people say, well, all they have to do really is go to this agency and they'll help them, or go to that agency and they'll help them. And the reality is that's not true at all. Each agency has its own provisions about what you have to do to get services, and that person may or may not fit those requirements, and it really is a very sophisticated situation. So they need reach out workers who to help them through the process. And I would do that for people, and sometimes it would take me just a couple months with one client. It could take me up to 2 years with another client, depending upon what the barriers were. My experience is that people are homeless for a reason. It's not, I read an article once before I started this work that said that someone lost their health care and so was homeless and couldn't get back in the system. Most people who understand the middle class structure system doesn't stay homeless very long. If you have someone on the streets who's been homeless for a year or more, there are some obstacles that that person needs to help them get through the process and get housing. And once we find that people are housed and they're stable, their chances of success greatly improve. So that's what the Tenant Resource Center does. We have people who come in who are homeless. We have a list of housing places. If they have employment, we can start the process with them. If they don't have employment, then we have to work with them to get some kind of income going so that they have a chance of getting housing. And I think you all know that Madison has a 3% vacancy rate. And that's for everyone. That's for people who have good income and are looking for a place. And then my clients who have practically no income and are looking for a place. So it's quite the struggle. Personal opinion is we are in crisis in this country around homelessness. Madison does not have any encampments going on. In your big cities on the West Coast, you have literally blocks of tent cities. People who are homeless and trying to get out of their situation and are facing great difficulty. So I have to tell you, I am so pleased to be working for the Tenant Resource Center. As I said, my background was working with people literally on the streets, but I've started working at the Tenant Resource Center and it's opened up a whole other group of people that I wasn't aware of who are struggling to keep a roof over their head. And the Tenant Resource Center does a lot to help those people maneuver the system so that they can stay housed. Thank you.
We have some brochures on the table in there. Yellow one, Mary. To volunteer. And another blue one that is basically a summary of our services.
I would say yes. They okay. At least know that they have the right resume, how to approach an employer, what agencies they can contact. Most of the clients I work with do not have that level of information. I'm sorry. You really raise an excellent point. And that is, I don't know where you got your tenants from, but the people that I work with who have been homeless for a year or more, yeah. And when I worked for an agency that you also had to have a mental health diagnosis. Mm-hmm. The worst clients, the most difficult clients I worked with weren't aware that they had a mental health diagnosis and was in denial about the situation that they're in. Most of my clients had a very, very difficult upbringing and did not have the kind of background that I was raised with. So you're talking about simple skills, like right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like gathering wood or even alerting you to the fact that the heat was gonna run out. Yeah. It is absolutely a two-way street. But for the clients that I worked with, they needed to have a case manager.
Yeah.
What you and I assume to know and to follow through on, they needed help with. And so if you wanted to do like a bell curve, right? You have the extremes on both ends. Some people that you would rent to, you wouldn't even have to talk to them. They would just take care of everything, right? And on the other end of the bell curve would be people who would be absolutely clueless. And so Madison is fortunate to have a process now. When I would finally be able to get someone housed, I could turn them over to a case manager. And that case manager would work with that person to keep them housed. But so, as I said, I worked with people with mental health diagnosis. But one of the things that I learned in the 4.5 years of doing street outreach is if people are on the streets for a year or more, there is a reason for it. And it could be mental health. That my clients, it was mental health. Sometimes it was alcohol and drug abuse. Sometimes it was cognitive delay. I have 4 clients right now that I'm working with, and I'm working with them because if they didn't have someone helping explain to them step by step what they needed to do, there would be no way they would get off the streets. There would be no way that they would know how to interact with the social service agencies to get their needs met. So I absolutely understand what you're saying, but you also need to know that there is a certain segment of the population that truly does not know, does not understand what they have to do to keep a place and make sure that they don't fall into homelessness. Well, not only is there the epic effect, as you call it, but there's gentrification going on. So the areas that used to be programs that or places that people used to be able to rent are dissipating. So it is really a challenging to take someone who's on SSI benefits. So let's just say they get $850 a month, their total income for the month, and find a unit that they can afford, plus, in addition to that, get food and pay the electric and the heat bill, and come out even. And as this gentleman mentioned, they may not necessarily have those skills, you know? Even middle-class people sometimes struggle with their budgets, right? But when you're talking about people who are living in poverty, there's a wonderful book written by a woman by the name of Dr. Ruby Payne, R-U-B-Y, and her last name is spelled P-A-Y-N-E. And she talks about different classes and different rules for people in different classes. And so the very wealthy, so we're talking about the millionaires and billionaires, they have their own unwritten rules about how to interact and behave with each other. We operate on a middle class system, right? Where, for an example, give you a perfect example. You're sick, you call the doctor, you schedule an appointment. The doctor expects you to show up at that appointment, right? It's your understanding, you're supposed to show up for that appointment, correct? I work with clients who, first of all, don't even know how to make a doctor's appointment. I schedule the appointment, I get them there, I follow up with them because they come from poverty class. And I'm not saying any class and their rules are different than anyone else's, but poverty class has developed their own rules for survival. And their rules do not necessarily fit with middle class rules for survival. So I have to say I've had nothing but wonderful experience with the health systems in Madison. But they get it. If I come in with a client who they know is homeless, they get that they have to have certain things in place, reminder calls or who's the contact to make sure that person shows up again. So we have different class rules. We have, and again, many of my clients, especially because they have a mental health illness, even if we're talking about depression, if you're depressed, you're not necessarily motivated to make sure you get to that doctor's appointment, right? And we have a declining housing market. And how do I get clients who have maybe been homeless for 2 years? And we have a landlord who wants 3 times their income in order to even qualify, and a 2-year non-broken housing history. How do I get them into a place like that? It's nigh onto impossible. And so what you do is you find the landlords who are generous and have a big heart, or who have gotten city and federal money to have units to house these folks. Because many of my clients would never, ever get a unit with a quote-unquote regular landlord. The landlord knows that this person has mental health issues or socialization issues or depression issues before they walk in. I'm sorry.
You're fine.
Okay.
But thank you, Mary. And do we have one more question, perhaps for Julio?
Oh, if I can add a little bit to that question. We are going to be seeing that what we are seeing now is also displacement. Not somebody who has been homeless and cannot access a home, but also, like, for example, all the development that is happening in the east of Madison, that was usually a more affordable area. What we are seeing, that area is being developed, all these high rises, incredibly expensive apartment. We are talking 1800 for a two bedroom. So people who have been living in there for 20 years, at some point they are going to be displaced. Like, hey, I can make a way lot more money in here, so I'm not renewing your lease, or I'm going to be asking something you cannot pay for it. So we are going to be seeing, especially I would say, the elderly, like people who are out of that home, they have been renting for 20 years and with literally nowhere to go, because they are entering in a market that it's basically way out of their means. That we are going to be seeing that a lot of that. And I don't think the city is addressing that problem with within a time frame.
Well, East Street is changing that way. You can see it when you drive down the street.
Yeah. It's, and they are seeing, like, many of these, like, really expensive new buildings, they always have affordable housing, Section 42, but it's an affordable within some means. Okay, you cannot make more than 40,000 a year, but you certainly need to make more than 30,000. I would say it's the level of comfortability of the landlord. I mean, if you can rent a home, a four-bedroom home, if you can rent it to a family that works at Epic with only two kids, okay, it's easier. So there are no rules about what a landlord can limit. If they say, like, okay, this is a three-bedroom apartment, and we only allow two people in there, they can do that. There is no restriction on that. So many times they also use that as a way of, I don't know. There is, on one side, like, if you have more people in the family, they are going to be pushing you into more expensive units. Like, you have four people, you need a four-bedroom. We won't even give you a three-bedroom. So you have to go into more expensive units. And there are actually no rules. No rules about what a landlord can say, like, this apartment is for this amount of people. There is, without any reasoning or logic behind. I only allow, as long as they do it, they are not discriminatory or retaliatory, there are no rules about that. If they want to say, this is a four-bedroom house for one person, they can do it.
Can I just add that the landlord-tenant rules have changed how many times? Four times in the last 10 years or so?
Or six.
Or six last, years?
Last Tuesday was the last rule. The last change, and it's... Actually, nobody knew what they voted on. Nobody had any clue what was the final law. It seems that it's going to be evictions easier, inspections harder. That's basically the reasoning behind. Most of the changes in these six law changes in the last years have been motivated mainly from Madison. Mm-hmm. That's basically, Madison has been the steam engine moving that, the apartment association of Madison. Even landlords are angry many times at those changes. Right. Because they say, like, I cannot catch up. I don't know if I'm doing it right. You are changing all these rules every 2 years, so there is no way I can catch up and know what I am doing is correct or not. This last change, like this last Tuesday change, many landlords were really, really, really angry about that change. Because especially this kind of, like, the making, like, a city inspections much harder for landlords, much harder for tenants. Many landlords, their reasoning is like, hey, no, I want the city inspection to come. I want to prove that my house is fine, that I am a good landlord. I am not this kind of guy renting whatever to whoever and going beyond the rules, because now all of a sudden there are no rules. Like, many landlords are really angry at that also. But it's basically the Apartment Association of Madison, that they have a really powerful lobby. And they are the ones who have been, like, doing all these changes. Like, many times when we go to do trainings all over the state, we do, like, this landlord training, like, basically explaining the laws. Many of the landlords, like, blame us. Like, why did you change this? It wasn't us. I promise you, it wasn't us. because they are angry, like, why would you do this? This was not a problem. Now you have created a problem. Now we don't know what to do because this law that you have implemented is in opposition to this other federal law, and we don't know what to do. It's like this last Tuesday, one of the main things landlords wanted to address was the emotional support animals, because basically they cannot put any restrictions on those. And either they don't want animals in the home or they want to charge for those animals. So what they pass, I think it's in direct opposition to the Americans with Disabilities Act. If they try to impose that, it's going to be a real mess. But they are like so in their own world that they don't... I guess they realize about that. They just, basically, I think the main thing was like making doctors and therapists afraid of signing this emotional support animals, like, we are going to go after you. If we discover that that's not a legit need, we are going to go after you. I don't know how they're going to do that.
Porchlight has a housing. They offer housing to probably your poorest people in the city. But the waiting list takes about a year and a half to 2 years. So we have a Housing First. I don't know if you've heard of it, the Housing First Placement Program, which is wonderful because all the agencies are working together now in identifying and serving people. So when there is a, now, even with Porchlight, it used to be Porchlight had two different types of units, one that they just maintained and kept their program going, and then one with the Housing First Program. But just recently they decided that all of their vacant units are going to go through the Housing First Placement process, which means that you have to have a survey, and depending upon, it's called a vulnerability score, you have to have a vulnerability score, and and they combine the length of homelessness according to the HUD definition, and I could have a whole discussion with you about the HUD definition and how it doesn't work, but if you combine those two scores, and then where you are on the list depends upon if you get offered a place. So right now that list is 800 people, and they have to wait for a vacancy to open up. So sometimes it literally takes 4 or 5 months once you're on top of the list to actually get a place. We are in a mess, you guys. I'm just saying we're in a mess when it comes to housing.
Thank you, Julio and Mary.
Tom Robinson will offer our closing words.
A righteous man knows the rights of the poor. A wicked man does not understand such knowledge. Proverbs 29:7.
Thank you.